It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The state budget deadline is 3 weeks from today, and the House has passed a spending plan. A bipartisan bill to improve rail safety in the Commonwealth moves forward, and questions continue about why the governor isn't being fully transparent about his daily schedule. It's our State Politics Roundtable with Katie Meyer, government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA. Mark Levy covers Pennsylvania government and politics for the Associated Press, and Spotlight PA's Capitol reporter, Stephen Caruso. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right, let's start with the budget. House Democrats use their slim majority to approve a budget for the new fiscal year that begins July 1st. It's actually about $1 billion above Governor Shapiro's proposed $44.4 billion spending plan. Stephen, let's start with you. Was there any Republican support for the increased spending or strictly a party line passage?
The bill passed party line, and Republicans have been pretty clear that they're trying to save the money that the state has. We have about a $13 billion, $12 billion surplus right now. Projections say that the state's revenues are not going to be as good in the future. There's always this concern of a future recession hanging over a lot of decisions. So Republicans have been pretty definitive, like, we shouldn't spend this down because we will set ourselves up for painful fiscal decisions in the future, to which Democrats have retorted pretty consistently, like, to varying degrees, we should spend some of it, though. We have so many needs in this state. You know, it's a rainy day fund, but there are a lot of places that are having rainy days right now, whether it's lead in schools, people who can't afford to, you know, feed their kids in the morning or what have you. So that's kind of the back and forth of this budget season. No Republicans voted for that budget when it came out of the House. And, you know, now it's off to the Senate and we'll see what happens next.
Mark, budget season, as Stephen calls it, what's been standing out? What have you been following in particular about budget season?
Well, it's been fluid. And for Josh Shapiro, the finances of the state improved within the 3 months since he proposed his budget. So what we did see was some tension with Democratic lawmakers who wanted more money in the budget, who were a little disappointed with his proposal for schools, and they followed through and put more money in and pointed to improved tax collections over the last several months. You know, every budget season you go into June, and it's a big horse trading month, and there's always satellite policy issues revolving around the core budget and the horse trading over money and programs. And there's always the question of will one of those policy issues get pulled into a final deal when we see what they come out with from behind closed doors around June 30th.
Katie?
Yeah, I think Mark mentioned education. That's something that is pretty central in this budget and is really central in the counter proposal that Democrats have made to Shapiro's budget. The increase in spending, the almost $1 billion that they want to put in, is almost exclusively for education. And specifically, they're earmarking more money for the poorest 100 schools in the Commonwealth. And I think underlying all of this is a decision by the Commonwealth Court earlier this year that said the Pennsylvania school funding system is essentially unconstitutionally unfair. And so as part of that, there is this need for lawmakers, unless the decision is appealed and overturned, which doesn't look that likely. There's this need for lawmakers to really overhaul the school funding system in the Commonwealth. We're not expecting that this year, but Democrats really see this budget, and advocates have pushed for this budget to be sort of what they call a down payment on an eventual need to overhaul spending. So that's really what you're seeing with Democrats trying to put in a lot more money for education.
Stephen Caruso.
You know, and just to build off something Mark said, like when you talk about other issues that could get kind of pulled into the budget conversation, it's like, you know, Democrats are super optimistic they could get a minimum wage increase this session. You know, Republicans in the state Senate and, I mean, in the House, who are in the minority now, they've talked a lot about regulatory reform, trying to make it easier for companies to get permits. It's something Josh Shapiro has signaled some openness to. You know, I think that, you know, Democrats have passed over bills on gun control, on LGBTQ rights. I mean, you know, I don't know if social issues necessarily get dragged in, but I think all of this stuff is sort of pieces on the table of a budget deal that we're all kind of just like keeping an eye on to see whether it moves this month or when they come back in the fall. I mean, these are all just like, you know, pawns, rooks, On the big chessboard of passing a budget.
Katie, to be clear, whether this big down payment or this down payment gets included in this budget or not, the legislature still has to come up with a plan to make education funding more equitable in the state.
Yes, again, unless the lawsuit gets overturned, which doesn't look that likely, or unless the ruling gets overturned, rather. But yeah, Kevin, I think one of the things that is clear is that some larger, you know, plan needs to be put in place to satisfy the terms of this lawsuit or and the ruling. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of lawmakers have said, you know, it's not going to happen this year. It probably is going to have to do with changing how much money is going through the state's fair funding formula. It's going to have to, you know, require a much deeper look at exactly how much money is needed to do that. Republicans have made it pretty clear that they want sort of parental choice style components to be part of this. So for instance, you know vouchers or vouchers light, which is, you know, giving scholarships to private schools that are funded by tax credits to private companies that fund them, that kind of thing. So there's going to be so much negotiation about this probably in the next couple of years, but this budget, we're sort of looking at it as a starting point.
Mark, this budget that was passed by the House, is it even going to be considered by the Senate, or are they just starting with their own and say, okay, you did what you did, we're going to do what we're going to do?
Well, yes and no. So the Senate will start off of this blueprint. I have no indication from them that they're going to simply propose their own new bill. They'll work. The expectation is that they will work off this, that they will negotiate basically with the governor's office at this point. You know, Democrats in the House and the Senate will have a say in it, but by and large, what I gather is that Senate Republicans are expecting to negotiate off this blueprint directly with the governor's office, and that to some degree it'll be up to the governor's office to bring Democrats in the House along once it goes back, assuming that the governor can get to a deal with Senate Republicans who control that chamber, 28-22, assuming the governor can get to a deal with the Senate Republican majority. It'll be on the expectations that it'll be on John Shapiro to carry House Democrats along and get votes there for a deal that he sees as satisfactory. But, you know, just kind of building on what Katie said is that Senate Republicans will want their own wants out of the education budget. And there will be talk about reducing corporate taxes. And these are things that, you know, Democrats in the House may have to swallow.
It's our Confluence Politics Roundtable. Earlier this week, the State House, with bipartisan support, passed a set of rules for rail safety in the Commonwealth. It includes rules about blocking railroad highway grade crossings that could block an emergency vehicle, prohibits trains longer than 8,500 feet in length, minimum crew levels. Stephen, what role did the derailment of the Norfolk Southern train in East Palestine, Ohio, play in the passage of this measure?
I think it's like the biggest contributor, because bills, at least on like staffing for rail, like mandating a minimum 2-person crew, they've been introduced back to 2015 with Republican co-sponsors. The bills haven't gone anywhere. And now, you know, we had this incident. It impacts Pennsylvania. And this bill just kind of moved very quickly through the Pennsylvania House. It got bipartisan support. And I think it kind of shows like the power of a who's the power of a big incident like East Palestine to sort of, you know, galvanize public attention. Polls have found that a lot of people want to see stricter regulations on railroads. And now, you know, we're seeing that fruit, and legislators have taken notice and passed this bill.
Were there any opposition points to some portions of this legislation? Because there were 62 House representatives who voted against this.
Yeah, the biggest opposition we saw was from the Chamber of Commerce had put out a bunch of letters opposing it, the State Railroad Association. The opposition mostly focused on this is going to be preempted, and it could increase prices for other businesses by increasing logistics costs. But, you know, I think it's just an issue where railroads have spent a lot of time lobbying the General Assembly on issues big and small. And I think that, you know, lawmakers are like, this is the chance to actually move. The public's on our side, and you know, voting against it. It was very quiet opposition. There wasn't a lot of advertising, hey, we're against this. It took some effort to figure out, like, where the opposition was coming from. They did their best effort, but it passed with 140 votes. So all the Democrats and about 40 Republicans back the bill. So now it goes to the Senate, and we'll see what happens there. It's controlled by Republicans. So
any thoughts from Katie or Mark on how it might bode in the Senate, because some of their party counterparts at the House did vote for this?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say if this type of fight is playing out in state houses across the country right now, some of these things, as Stephen pointed out, had pre-existed the East Palestine derailment, but it has inflamed the debate in a lot of state houses. And what we're seeing is that Democratic state houses are moving a lot more quickly on these things, and Republican state houses are stalling. And so you see where both, you know, the partisan lines are drawn, but the lines between unions and railroad owners are drawn. And there is resistance among Republicans to these types of things, Republicans who tend to be aligned with their chambers in their states. And so to the extent that most Republicans in the House voted against it, you can expect that most Republicans in the Senate will be against it. And that is not a good indicator for a bill to come to the floor.
It's The Confluence, and you're listening to our State Politics Reporter Roundtable. We're joined by Katie Meyer, Stephen Caruso, and Mark Levy. Former Governor Tom Wolf made transparency a part of his administration, but it seems that Josh Shapiro is not following in stride. Latest example has been the revelation that Shapiro does not publicly share his calendar, who he meets with, and what's being discussed. Katie, why does the calendar matter?
The calendar is really a tool for journalists, for the public, to be able to get a little window into what Shapiro is doing day to day. So we have a list of public events that the governor goes to. He makes those public as a matter of course before they happen. But his days are much fuller than that. And so, for instance, while the budget is being negotiated, which lawmakers is he meeting with the most? Are there interest groups that he's meeting with? And that's a question that kind of persists no matter what's going on. Who is he meeting with most frequently? What are they discussing? And so, yeah, as you mentioned, as a sort of a rebuttal to his predecessor's kind of reluctance to share full calendars, Governor Tom Wolf, at the end of every week, would put out a pretty detailed list of where he went, what he did day to day. And it would include who he met with, which advisors, which members of like the private sector, what they discussed. And there would be some redactions, you know, you didn't know where he was at all times, but it was pretty thorough. And that was more than he had to share. So now Shapiro is really rolling that back. And he's totally allowed to do it under case law that's been established in the state under the right to know law, but it's much less transparent than Wolf was.
More than he had to. Are there bare minimums where the governor has to do, Katie?
Well, it really depends on how you keep the calendar. And this is sort of an interesting quirk of how the lawsuits over this law have played out. But what we've kind of ended up with in the state is if you categorize your calendars as like personal notes and working papers, that's the term they use. And the criteria for that is you can't really share it widely within the office. It's only for personal scheduling. It includes like doctor's appointments, stuff about your kids, things like that. Then the calendar is totally exempt. And so that is what Shapiro is calling his calendars. Those are the, like, clearly, you know, he did this on purpose. That's just how he's keeping the calendars that are used personally in the office. And under a couple different precedents in Pennsylvania, you just don't have to share a calendar. It's like that. Now, we saw in like previous administrations, not everybody took this approach. Tom Corbett actually got into like a long fight with Mark's colleague, Mark Scolforo of the AP. And there was a years long battle over how much of a calendar Corbett had to share. And he kept them differently. And he ended up sharing more than Shapiro is now. He shared who he met with and when, just not what they discussed. So again, there are grades to this, but Shapiro has arranged his calendar in such a way that he really doesn't have to share anything.
All right, Mark, you want to chime in briefly about your colleague, Mark Scolforo, who Katie just mentioned?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it just goes to show you how news organizations can fight and fight and fight, and government will later find ways just to keep things secret anyway, regardless of what the court tells them to do.
All right. To any of you, have you or your colleagues in a way been frustrated or Katie has called this a tool or a toolbox to do your jobs. Have you specifically been blocked in trying to find out something by this? Any of you?
Well, I would say that this is one of several ways that the Shapiro administration has sought to kind of lock down information. And Stephen can talk about this much more because he's done some real reporting on this earlier in the administration. But there have been several examples, and I'll let Stephen kind of get into some of his own reporting there.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Katie, I'm not going to lie. You put me on the spot. And
sorry.
I'm not in my brain. No, I think that there has, when it comes to transparency in the governor's office, I would even say, like, under Wolf, he liked to talk about it a lot, but I feel like when push came to shove, they'd find ways to try and work around us. With the Shapiro administration, you know, I filed my share of right to knows. I've had a few weird denials. I've then sometimes worked with them and been able to get information back on, say, spending. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm also, I'm maybe too generous. I'm willing to give some time. But I would say early on, we see examples in reporting on the way they've used our campaign finance system to try and hide expenses for Shapiro sitting courtside at the Sixers games. And we've seen questions about, you know, his Super Bowl tickets, like on stuff like this. Like, I think there's questions, or the inaugural funding, for instance.
Yes.
I remember my colleague Kate Huangpu did. I think, like, there's lots of questions about, like, they're making lots of decisions on how they share their finances that make it more opaque and make it harder to find it out. And I think it's that they're justifiable decisions. No one's proven wrongdoing, but, like, they could have made it more transparent if they wanted to, but they chose not to.
When Governor Shapiro was elected, he left the post of Attorney General. We now have a couple of contenders that have said they want to run for that office, Attorney General Eugene DePasquale and Joe Kahn. Mark, I'm going to start with you on this. Is acting Attorney General Michelle Henry running?
No, and actually she is the Attorney General. She's been confirmed by the Senate, which requires a 2/3 vote. So she is the Attorney General. She was Josh Shapiro's top deputy for his 6 years as Attorney General before he was sworn in as governor, and he appointed her to finish the last 2 years of his term, which will be up in early 25. She'll leave office, so the election of 2024 voters will pick a replacement for her.
Okay. And I recall when Tom Corbett was elected governor, he appointed, but his appointee actually had to promise the Senate that she would not run for re-election. And Michelle Henry did that voluntarily, basically.
That's right. Some of the senators on the panel initially reviewing her nomination encouraged her to run or expressed disappointment in the fact that she wouldn't run. She's a career prosecutor from Bucks County. She's handled some the county's highest profile cases of the last 20 years. And I think is viewed across the aisles from Democrat to Republican as very professional. As I understand it, she was a registered Republican. I don't know what the case is now, but it is customary for one party or the other to extract a promise from a nominee for an elected position, someone who's being appointed to it, to ask them not to run after they fill the unexpired term for which they've been nominated, whether it's a judge or a row office like this. I think, you know, a minority party and might be seeking to avoid having, you know, a nominee having an electoral advantage going into the election.
I mentioned DePasquale. He has a fair amount of name recognition. He won statewide elections as Auditor General. Briefly, Mark, what do we know about Joe Kahn?
So Joe Kahn is also a career prosecutor. He spent 10 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Philadelphia. He spent 6 years as an assistant district attorney in the city of Philadelphia. He's probably best known to voters in the Southeast. One, because he ran for district attorney of Philadelphia in 2017. He came in second in the Democratic primary to the current district attorney, Larry Krasner. But also, too, because he led a couple sweeping federal corruption investigations into City Hall in Allentown and in Reading. Now, he left before the investigation culminated in all of its convictions, but At the time he was there, investigators had secured more than a half dozen guilty pleas from people in and around City Hall. Ultimately, the investigation culminated in the conviction of mayors of Allentown and Reading. Those are his claims to fame. He does also have a brother in the State House of Representatives, and he started a political action committee to help the children of immigrants like himself. His father immigrated from Pakistan.
Okay. Very briefly, Mark, do we expect any more candidates before this election?
Yes, the office is going to be open, which means that there's an even better chance for someone to win it. There's no incumbent. There are no Republicans who have declared publicly for the race, but we expect more, and we expect more Democrats, too. The election's in November of 2024.
All right. And briefly to each of you, we have just a minute left. What's on your radar in the weeks ahead? Katie, are you going to say budget?
Budget. Yeah, education specifically. I want to see what happens in the Senate with that deal.
Okay. And Stephen, what about you? What's on your radar? Budget and something else?
Yeah, I would say keeping an eye on energy policies, what could potentially move for the General Assembly, whether it's solar, Reggie, or who else knows?
Well, let me quickly follow up on that. Is there something specific that stands out with solar?
Yeah, a potential for community solar in this budget deal as everyone tries to come to that deal where everyone's happy with the spending and you got to have some policies to sweeten the pot.
Okay, Mark, what is on your radar from the legislature or for the governor's office, state government as a whole in the days and weeks ahead?
Primarily just watching to see how Josh Shapiro handles his first big budget month. These things can be very determinative in how a governor is going to perform in their 4 years in office. And so it's his first big test of getting a budget across the finish line, being able to persuade his fellow Democrats to go along with him if he gets a deal with Republicans, and seeing what else he might be able to push across the finish line with a spending plan.
We've been speaking with Mark Levy, who covers Pennsylvania government politics for the Associated Press, Katie Meyer, government editor and reporter for Spotlight PA, and Spotlight PA's Capitol reporter, Stephen Caruso. Thanks, all of you, for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, to foster inclusivity, the State Education Department is starting a pilot program to provide instruction in various classes on political, economic, and social contributions of individuals with disabilities. Thanks to Laura Satsui and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Till next time, hope you have a good day of good news.